The principle of compositionality says that, except in a few cases, the meanings of complex expressions are determined by the meanings of their constituents and by the manner in which those constituents are put together. The point of allowing for exceptions is that we want to recognize, we want to be able to allow that there are some phrases in language, they're generally called idioms in the literature, which get their meanings as wholes, not derived from the meanings of the parts. But the principle of compositionality holds that there can only be at most a finite number of these phrases. And in fact, it will generally be quite a small finite number. And that the vast majority of complex compound expressions in the language will be formed from simpler expressions and have their meanings determined by those simpler expressions. Now, what is the point of the principle? Well, it is supposed to help us model what is called creative language use. Creative language use is the ability of speakers to understand and form new sentences, sentences that they have not encountered before. And in fact, when children are learning language, there is a kind of a takeoff point after which they suddenly start producing and being able to understand a wealth of new sentences and phrases that they haven't heard before. And of course, creativity doesn't stop when we reach adulthood and count ourselves as pretty much knowing the language. On the contrary, if you consider any reasonably sophisticated novel that you have read and have a look at it, you'll see that virtually all the sentences in that novel were ones that you hadn't encountered before. And yet you understood them without difficulty. Now, why is that? How is it that we are able to form and understand new sentences on the basis of not only a finite training in the language, but a relatively short training? Well, the principle of compositionality is supposed to provide an explanation of that, what philosophers call an abductive explanation. That's to say, an inference to the best explanation. If we suppose that in understanding new sentences, what you're doing is putting together familiar words in new ways, ways that are allowed for by the grammar of the language, then it seems that we can give an explanation in the sense of modelling your ability to comprehend new sentences. We can think of you as simply computing the meanings of complex expressions from the meanings of the simpler expressions that you already know and the grammatical constructions that you slot them into, which again you're already familiar with. If you know the grammar of a language and you know a reasonable proportion of its lexicon, that's to say its list of words and their meanings, then you can generate endless new sentences. There are certain constructions in language which can be iterated, which can be repeated. So the number of new sentences that you can form and understand is potentially unlimited. And as I said at the beginning, the adherents of the principle of compositionality allow that there can be a finite number of exceptions to it, so that there can be a finite number of expressions, the idioms, that you have to learn individually. You have to learn them one by one. You can't compute their meanings from the meanings of their parts, because their parts are not semantically active, right? The phrases are given meanings as a whole. And you therefore have to learn that meaning as a unit. And so long as the number of expressions that are like that is finite, and indeed a quite small finite number, and in practice it is, the demands placed on you will not be too great. The reason why we need the principle of compositionality in general is that if we thought all language was like that, if we thought that you had to learn the meanings of all complex expressions from scratch, treating these expressions as units and learning for each one its meaning as a separate exercise, then you would be facing an infinitistic task, a task which would require you to learn the meanings of an infinite number of expressions. And we suppose that that is not humanly possible, because we are finite beings with finite brains. So we want an account of our understanding that manages to marry these two constraints, in effect, that I've been dealing with. The first one is the one that I've just mentioned, namely that we are finite beings. So we want our account of understanding to be finitely based, capable of mastery by a finite being. But given the creativity of language, we also want the speaker to be able to form and understand an unlimited number of sentences. And the principle of compositionality gives us a way of, as I say, marrying up those two objectives, which initially look as if they are in tension with one another. Actually, it's worth saying a little bit about idioms before we move on. So I've said that we can allow a finite number of idioms in the language without threatening the learnability of the language. Okay, so the point I was making earlier was that if we didn't have a principle of compositionality, if all units of meaning, and in particular all complex units of meaning, had to be learned individually, then the language would be unlearnable, because the language generates an infinite number of complex expressions. So the principle of compositionality is there to model the learnability of language. But as I've said, it concedes that there are some complex expressions, the idioms, which you do have to learn individually. These idioms are made up of words, but the meanings of the words are no longer, as I put it earlier, semantically active. They don't determine the meaning of the whole thing. Now, the point that I want to sort of fit in as an aside is that it actually seems to me that the number of expressions that are genuinely idiomatic in that sense is really very small indeed, because most common idioms do actually conform to the principle of compositionality, albeit in a slightly weakened version. Take an example. Let's take an idiom. So the one that pops into my head is hoist with his own petard. That's a rather old idiom. You may not have heard it, but yeah, I think it's still a fairly standard expression. And what it means is confounded by one's own devices. So it's used of people who set up a trap for somebody else, and then they fall into it themselves. And we say, oh, he was hoist with his own petard. Now, quite a lot of people know that idiom, but don't know where it comes from. And so they understand it in a purely idiomatic way. if you ask them, well, what do those individual words mean? And how do they contribute to the meaning of the whole thing? Or do they contribute to the meaning of the whole thing? They wouldn't be able to answer. And I mean, well, just take myself as an example. For many years, that was the position I was in before I bothered to find out. I knew the idiom. I knew what it meant as a whole. But I didn't think at all about the contribution of the individual words. And I didn't know what a petard was. So I didn't understand. If I'd thought about it, which I don't think I ever did, I wouldn't have understood the phrase hoist with one's own petard. Then I looked it up and I found that a petard is a bomb, an old kind of bomb or mine used in early modern battles. And so hoist in this context means blown up. Hoist with one's own petard means you lay a mine and then you're blown up by it yourself. Okay, so that's the origin of the idiom. And it's reasonable enough to say that you can use those, you can use that phrase non-compositionally as a pure idiom, and you would still count as understanding it. So if you use the phrase and somebody said, "What does that mean?" and you said, "Oh, it just means confounded by your own devices." And if the person then persists and says, well, how exactly does it come to mean that? What are the contributions of the individual words? If you say, well, I've got no idea, as I would have said before I found out, I think, you know, you would still count as understanding the idiom. You're understanding it as a pure idiom, not in a compositional way. However, the reason why I say the principle of compositionality in these cases is still active, albeit in a weakened form, is that although you can understand these phrases, and many people do, non-compositionally, the semantic parts of the idiom are not entirely dead, and they can be resurrected on occasion if necessary. So, you know, you can say, for example, I mean, if somebody literally set a bomb in a building for somebody else, in order to kill somebody else, and then made a mistake, as sometimes happens in these cases, and the bomb goes off in his face and blows him up. You know, I might say, well, he was quite literally hoist with his own petard. And there I'm saying both that he was confounded by his own devices in the general idiomatic sense, but I'm also saying that he was literally blown up by his own bomb. So I'm in, if I do that, I'm resurrecting the literal, the original sense of the idiom, in which all the words are semantically active and contribute to the meaning of the whole. Hoist really does mean lifted up. Petard really does mean bomb. And our ability to do that shows that the idiom, although it is an idiom in the sense that I defined earlier, it hasn't completely forgotten its origin. And that origin can be revived. So that the principle of compositionality is still in some sense there in the background and can be called upon. There's still a sense in which the phrase, and the way I put it a minute ago, if you noticed, was I said, I talked about the literal meaning of the phrase. Well, I don't know if that's the best way to put it, but that's one way to capture the fact that even though the phrase nowadays has an idiomatic meaning which is unconnected with bombs, its original meaning, what I was calling its literal meaning, is still sort of bubbling away beneath the surface and can be drawn upon as necessary. As I said earlier, it hasn't entirely died, that original literal meaning. Similarly, just to give you another example of the same thing, the phrase kick the bucket means die, or at least it used to. I don't think it's a very common idiom nowadays, but it used to be a fairly common idiom. And the origin of that expression, I believe, I haven't looked it up actually, but I think it's the from hanging. When people were hung, they were put on a bucket or some kind of support first, which was then kicked away so that the rope could tighten round the poor victim's neck. So kicking the bucket is getting rid of the thing that's stopping you from hanging so that you die. Now, again, you can have exactly the same scenario. And so, you know, if somebody to sort of combine the two examples that I've been using. Suppose somebody left a bomb inside a bucket in order to trap somebody, in order to go off when somebody else was around. So it's a device to murder somebody else. And he sets it all up, but then just as he's going, he accidentally kicks the bucket over and the bomb goes off, killing him. Well, that's a case in which you might say, well, actually, he was quite literally hoist with his own petard and he quite literally kicked the bucket. So again, you can recover the original meanings of both idioms, really. And that wouldn't be possible if these idioms were pure units which couldn't be decomposed at all into semantically significant parts. So in other words, if these idioms were themselves functioning just like words, simple words, that's to say, words that don't have any semantically significant parts, like hat or book or hoist or kick, right? If the idioms were themselves just like long words, then you wouldn't be able to recover any meaning from their parts because their parts wouldn't have any meaning. Just as in the word kick, the letter K doesn't have any meaning. K doesn't mean something in a way which contributes to the meaning of the whole word. So, yeah, I mean, that gives you an important sort of point of comparison, which perhaps I should have mentioned earlier, to give you an example where the principle of compositionality doesn't apply. We're saying that it applies to sentences. It doesn't apply to individual words. Words get their meanings as units. Their meanings are not functions of the meanings of their component parts, which in the case of words are letters, say, or phonemes. The individual phonemes that make up a word are meaningless, and the meaning of the word is given to it de novo, as one can say. So in other words, it's not a function of anything. It's not a function of the meanings of the parts. So what I've been saying there is that idioms in the strict sense in which we're using that word in this context, namely complex phrases that are in some sense made up of words, but the words are no longer semantically active at all, and the idiom has a meaning as a unit, not as a function of its component words. It seems to me that that's a useful notion, but we have to be careful with it because in the case of very many idioms, the component words are still in some sense semantically active, they can be reactivated. So that it's not the case that most ordinary idioms just don't conform to the principle of compositionality at all. Okay, let's move on and look at some objections to the principle of compositionality. I've told you what the motivation for it is, to model the learnability of language, the creativity of language. The objections that people have raised against it are generally on the basis that the principle, you might say, underestimates the innovative capacity of language, its creative capacity, so that uses of language are much more unpredictable than the principle of compositionality would lead you to expect. They're much more context dependent, right? So that what a particular sentence means is not simply a function of the meanings of the words and the way they're put together, but also of the context in which it's uttered. Now, it's clearly the case that there is a great deal of contextuality, context sensitivity in language, what philosophers call indexicality. So that in the case of many sentences, their meanings do vary from context to context. So, I am hungry as said by me in some sense means something different from I'm hungry when you say it, because we're referring to different people. And that is fixed by the context. In this particular case, it's fixed by the speaker. But there are lots of indexical words like I in the language which hook up with an aspect of the context of utterance to fix the meaning of the sentence. Everyone recognises that we make use of indexical words like I and here and now, and that in some sense, as I was putting it, the meanings of sentences containing these indexical words do vary from context to context and aren't simply a function of the component words. But a lot of philosophers also think that there's an element of constancy from context to context. So if we go back to the example I used, I am hungry, as said by me or as said by you, well, we're referring to different people, but there's an aspect of the meaning of that sentence, I am hungry, which doesn't vary between our different utterances of it. There's a common content to both our utterances of that sentence. What is that common content? Well, roughly, as I was implying, we're both saying that the speaker of this sentence is hungry. There is a constancy of content with indexical words from one occasion to another, one occasion of use to another. The philosopher David Kaplan used the word character to refer to that constant aspect of meaning. So in Kaplan's terminology, the character of the sentence, I am hungry, is constant. And that applies to all indexicals. Indexicals have a character, as well as what we'll later talk about under the label of sense. So we can think of the principle of compositionality as applying to the meanings of sentences in the sense of their characters, in the sense of that aspect of their meaning that remains constant from one occasion to another. So I think that an objection to the principle of compositionality on the basis of the fact that language contains indexical words like I and you and here, that isn't very compelling. The principle of compositionality can adjust to that. However, a number of writers have pushed that style of objection further. By that I mean they have said that the problem of indexicality, the problem of context dependence, is much deeper, runs much deeper than just a few words like I and you and me. In fact, it ultimately applies to all words. All words can vary their content depending on their context of use. So let's look at a couple of examples. And if you look at the passage from Rane Le Havre that I've quoted on page 7 of the book, you'll get a flavour of the kind of objection to compositionality that I'm talking about. So Le Havre is talking about the word red. And, I mean, this is supposed to be a typical example. The idea is, look, if the principle of compositionality doesn't apply to a word like red, then really there's no hope for it. But here's Le Havre's argument that redness, if you like, is radically context dependent. So you can't, as it were, give an account up front of what it is for anything to be read and say, oh, well, that's the meaning of the word. What it is for something to be read is radically context dependent. It depends on the something, it depends on the context of utterance and so on. So here's what he says. What it is for a bird to count as read is not the same as what it is for other kinds of objects to count as red. For a bird to be red in the normal case, it should have most of the surface of its body red, though not necessarily its beak, legs, eyes, and of course its inner organs. Furthermore, the red colour should be the bird's natural colour, since we normally regard a bird as really red, even if it is painted white all over. A kitchen table, on the other hand, is red even if it is only painted red, and even if its natural colour underneath the paint is, say, white. Moreover, for a table to be red, only its upper surface needs to be red, not necessarily its legs and its bottom surface. Similarly, a red apple needs to be red only on the outside, but a red hat needs to be red only on its external upper surface, so not on the inside. A red crystal is red both inside and outside, and a red watermelon is red only inside. And so on. He gives plenty of other examples: a red book, a red newspaper, red house, red car, red star, red glaze, red mist, red powder. I don't think he mentions a red in the political sense, but that there's that as well, a red political party. And his conclusion is, to quote again, "What counts for one type of thing to be red is not what counts for another." Of course, he says, there is a feature that is common to all the things which count non-metaphorically as red, namely that some part of them or some item related to them must appear wholly and literally reddish. But that is only a very general necessary condition and is far from being sufficient for a given object to count as red. So that's Le Havre. And interestingly, there's a passage from Travis, which I'll also quote, which is on page 8, where he actually contests what Le Havre says about the painted bird case, but in such a way as to give support to the general thesis. So he gives this example: "Pia's Japanese maple is full of russet leaves. Believing that green is the colour of leaves, she paints them. Returning, she reports, 'That's better, the leaves are green now.' She speaks truth. A botanist friend then phones, seeking green leaves for a study of green leaf chemistry. 'The leaves on my tree are green,' Pia says, 'you can have those.' But now Pia speaks falsehood." End of quote. So at this point, I suggest you have a think about those passages, looking at the text of them in the typescript of my book, and without reading on to see what I think about them, which I'm going to tell you anyway in this lecture, without doing that, spend a few minutes thinking yourself about those objections and whether you think they're good objections, and if you don't, how you would answer them. So I suggest you take a 10-minute break to do that, and then resume, and I'll tell you what I think. Okay, well, my feeling about these objections is that they don't really work. And in fact, the giveaway, I think, is the concession that Le Havre makes in the second passage that I quoted. There he says, "Of course there is a feature that is common to all the things which count non-metaphorically as red, namely that some part of them or some item related to them must appear wholly and literally reddish." So in that concession that he makes, he agrees that a red object must have some part or be related in an appropriate way to some object that appears wholly and literally reddish. That's his phrase. Now, it seems to me the obvious thing to do here is to fasten on that phrase, because what Le Havre is in effect doing, although he doesn't recognise this, is that he's operating a kind of split level or hierarchical structure in which you have a bunch of things in the primary level that appear wholly and literally reddish, and then you have a secondary level which contains a lot of other things that are in some way related to an item in the primary level. So they might have a part that appears wholly and literally reddish, or they might be suitably related to something that appears wholly and literally reddish. So I could actually use the example I gave, which he doesn't give. A red political party, it's a left-wing political party. Why is it called a red political party? Because of the flag. The flag is red, and the flag is literally red. Now, given that he's operating that kind of hierarchy, it's then natural to say, well, maybe we need two different accounts, one for the primary level and one for the secondary level. And in the case of the primary level, you might say the basic sense of red is appearing wholly and literally reddish. I mean, let's take an example. I wonder if any of you remember playing as children the balloon game. I not only played that as a child, but I've played it since with children and nephews and what have you. And in the balloon game, there are various coloured, you roll a die and you try and fill your balloon picture with balloons, and the balloons are little coloured discs. So the red balloon is a red circular disc, and it's completely red, I think, on both sides. So it is wholly and literally red, or appears wholly and literally reddish. And the reason why he's put in appears there is because, of course, objects look different in different lighting conditions, but we operate with standard or normal lighting conditions, so that when we say that an object is red, what we mean is that it appears reddish in ordinary daylight, something like that, or under normal lighting conditions, and to normal observers. So we're not saying that this red balloon disc is going to appear reddish to absolutely everyone in every circumstance. No. When we say that it's red, we mean that in normal conditions, to normal perceivers, it appears reddish. And that's not a non-circular definition of the word red, okay? Because I've used the word again in the definition. So if you were trying to define the word red and you said, okay, well, the definition of red is something like looks red in standard conditions to standard observers, you're not defining it non-circularly. You're using the same word again in the definiens, as we call it, the item, the part of the definition that is doing the defining. But in that case, there's a good argument for saying that you can't avoid doing that. And although the definition is circular, it's not useless, it does draw a connection between being red and looking red, and that's an important connection. It is essential to a red object that it look red in suitable conditions. What people sometimes say is that it identifies red as an experiential property. Okay. Well, we don't want to get sidetracked at this point into a disquisition on colour vision. What I want that point for, really, is to analyse Le Havre's concession in that second passage as going further than he perhaps intended, because it seems to me that he's in effect saying, if you just confined the principle of compositionality to the primary level, the level at which we're talking about things like that balloon disc, then yes, the meaning of a whole sentence containing the word red would be a function of the meanings of the parts. The principle of compositionality would apply. So the word red would mean appears wholly and literally reddish. And that's what it would mean. That's what the word would mean, and it's also what the word would mean in the context of a sentence. Now, I suspect that Le Havre will be happy with that so far. I don't know, but My guess is that he would be happy with that so far, but that he would then say, ah, yes, but now when you proceed to the secondary level, the level at which an object can count as red, even if it's merely related to a literal red thing, or is red in one of its parts, at that secondary level, you've just got too many different cases for a systematizing principle like the principle of compositionality to cope with. You're not, in understanding the word, the meaning of the word red at the primary level, you're not going to be equipped to understand all its various uses at the secondary level. You know, once you've learned what your red balloon is, that doesn't tell you what a red watermelon is. You might think, you would assume probably that a red watermelon had to look red on the outside, but that's not the case. That's not how we use the phrase, a red watermelon. So the primary level, I think Le Havre would say, is all very well, and you can have the principle of compositionality for that. I'll give it to you for free. But it's not going to work at the secondary level, which is, let's face it, where most of the language is, I think he would say. Or at least very many. I don't know about most, but very many uses of the word red aren't going to operate in the simple balloon way, in the example that I gave. We want to be able to say things like, that's a red hat, and the fact that it's black on the inside doesn't matter. It doesn't stop it being a red hat. Okay. Well, my response to that, which I spell out at some length in the chapter of the book, is that, well, it's a sort of a combination of two points. One is to say that all these secondary uses of red can be systematized to a greater extent than Le Havre is allowing. That's one point. And the second point is that the remaining cases, the ones that can't be systematized, they do indeed have to be learnt on a one-off basis, but they can be learnt on that basis. They can be learnt as and when they arise. They don't need to be learnt in advance. So let me explain those two points. The first point is that although Le Havre manages to give quite a long list of different red things, and yeah, they do seem to be red in different ways, they group themselves into sorts. So, for example, one example I give in the book is, you know, once you've learnt what it is for a car to be red, you've got a pattern there. You don't then have to start all over again to find out what it is for a bus to be red or a train to be red. Same with the bird example, which Le Havre does have. What is a red bird? Well, a red bird, as he says, doesn't have to be red all over in all its parts. It has to be substantially red on most of or main parts of its body. Well, once you've learnt that, you've got it. And different red birds are red in different ways, but they all count as being a red bird by virtue of this sort of general concept of what it is to be red for a bird. And you notice I use the phrase there, red for a bird. That's something that's implicit in Le Havre's objection, that red is, the adjective red is, as we say, attributive, or can function attributively. And that means that to be red for a bird is different from what it is to be red for a book or red for a hat. And normally, when you say things like red hat, you mean red for a hat. So you mean the adjective red attributively. You mean not red in just any old way, but red in the way that is appropriate for a hat. So, you know, a hat that is black but has a little red label on the inside doesn't count as a red hat, even though part of it is wholly and literally reddish. But that's not the relevant part. The relevant part, as Le Havre says, is its exterior upper surface. So adjectives like red often function attributively, and that means that you have to learn what it is for something to be red in different kinds of cases. But my first point against Le Havre is that these cases form themselves naturally into groups, so that the task is more manageable than he makes out. But of course, and here we move on to the second point, there are plenty of ad hoc uses of the word red, which can't be systematized. And I give an example somewhere around here in the chapter of a children's game where white ping pong balls have letters written on them, and they themselves are supposed to represent coloured objects of a certain sort. So a white ping pong ball with a black R marked on it might count for the purposes of the game as a red apple. Finding the red apple in the room in this game would be a matter of locating this white table tennis ball, which has got a black letter R marked on it. And for the purposes of the game, that object counts as a red apple. Now that's, as we say, a purely ad hoc use, in the sense that you wouldn't be able to predict that from the ordinary use of the word red, but it's a perfectly acceptable extension of that ordinary use. And it's an extension made on this one-off basis. And you have to learn it, so the game has to be taught to the children before they can play it. But once it has been taught, they understand it and they can play it. So this is a case where you have a use of the adjective red, which is not envisaged, as it were, not specifically envisaged in the systematic account, the account that's given in the dictionary, if you like. It's an extension of that use, but it can be learnt on an ad hoc basis. And the fact that there's an infinite number of such uses, right, there's endless possible extended uses of the word red like that, that doesn't represent a challenge to the learnability of language, because you don't have to know them all, right? You learn them on an ad hoc basis, and then you forget them, right? Because they're not really part of the language that you're going to use day in, day out. But the fact that there's an infinite number of possible extended uses of the word red doesn't matter, because you don't have to learn them. Insofar as you need any of them, you can learn them one by one on a one-off basis. So there's no problem there for a finite being confronting an infinite number of sentences, the meanings of which can't be computed in advance on the basis of a finite training in a finite lexicon and a finite grammar. It's right that those meanings can't be computed in advance by that kind of being, equipped in that way, but they are outliers as far as the language is concerned. They're not a part of the language that you need to know in order to count as having mastered that language. And insofar as you need to know them, they can be learnt on a one-off basis. Let's go back to the Travis quote about Pia and her leaves, and see how what I've been saying would apply to that passage. So you remember, that's a case where we're talking about the sentence, "The leaves on my tree are green." And Pia has painted the red, as they were, leaves on her maple tree green. And Travis's point is that in one context, so when she's looking at them after she's finished painting them, the sentence, "The leaves on my tree are green," is true. But that in another context, that's to say when her botanist friend rings her up for some green leaves for an experiment, then in that context, the sentence, "The leaves on my tree are green," is false, says Travis. Why does that challenge the principle of compositionality? Let's just spell it out. It's worth being explicit about this. Because you have a single sentence in two different, used in two different contexts, And in one context, it's true, according to Travis, and in the other, false. So, he doesn't say this explicitly, but it's implicit, we can't have to do with the same meaning. It can't be the case that this form of words means the same in both contexts, because you couldn't have, this is an implicit assumption of the argument, a sentence with a single meaning which was both true and false. The meaning must change if the truth value changes. That is the idea. And yet this bunch of words, the leaves on my tree are green, it's the same sentence on each occasion of use, but it means something different on the second occasion from the first, because it's moved from true to false. So its meaning can't simply be a function of the words and their meanings and the way they're put together, because those, Travis thinks, stay the same. The sentence on each occasion of use, the sentence is made up of exactly the same words, and the implicit assumption is that those words have the same meaning on each occasion of use. Now, the way I've just put that suggests one way in which you might challenge Travis's argument. You might object that, in fact, not only does the sentence change its meaning from one occasion to the next, but the words also change their meaning. So you might say that the word green means something different in the first context, after Pia has just painted her leaves and is looking at them, from the second context in which she's on the phone to the biologist. That is, and the reason why that would count as a defense of the principle against Travis's attack is that you would no longer have a counterexample. Right, so to get a counterexample to the principle of compositionality, you need to have a case of a sentence which is composed of words, and the meaning of which, the meaning of the whole sentence, is not a function of the meanings of the words and the way they're put together. It may involve those things. Those things may be relevant, but other factors are relevant too. So, and in particular, as Travis wants, we need to look at the context. And there's an ineradicable contextual indexical element to the meaning of the sentence, "The leaves on my tree are green," which means that the principle of compositionality on its own is not sufficient to account for the meaning of the whole expression. So that's how it's supposed to function as a counterexample, the peer example. But now if we object that not only does a sentence change its meaning from one context to the other, the words do as well. So the word green changes its meaning from the first context to the second context, then you no longer have a counterexample to the principle of compositionality. Okay, this would be a slightly ironic strategy to use against Travis, because in effect what you'd be doing is you'd be pushing the idea of contextuality even further than he does, and you'd be saying, yeah, not merely is the sentence dependent on context for its meaning, but the words are as well, and in particular the word green changes its meaning from one context to the next. So we no longer have a counterexample to the principle of compositionality. However, somebody who really wants to defend the principle of compositionality would be advised not to go that route, because it would leave the status of the principle of compositionality mysterious, and one wants to defend it in as direct a way as possible. And the way I would defend it is by saying, well, we need again to distinguish between primary and secondary uses of words. So just as I said with the case of the word red, I would say with the word green, it has a primary use in which it applies to things that appear greenish wholly and literally, so like the green balloon in the balloon game, and then it has secondary uses. Those secondary uses involve a relation to something that appears greenish or having a part that is greenish. And these secondary uses group themselves into sorts, so the learning of them is manageable by a finite being. But again, there are ad hoc uses of the word green, just like red, which have to be learned on a one-off basis. There's an infinite number of such ad hoc uses, but that doesn't threaten the learnability of language because we don't need to know them all. Those we do need to know, we can learn on an ad hoc one-off basis. So coming back to Travis's example, what I'd say about that is that the first sentence, the first time Pia utters a sentence, "The leaves on my tree are green," after she's just painted them, that's a primary use of the word green, and the sentence is literally true. That's like the balloon game case. When her biologist friend rings her up and asks for green leaves for an experiment, and Pia says, the leaves on my tree are green, you can have those, Travis goes on to say, but now Pia speaks falsehood. But I say that she goes on speaking the truth in this primary sense. The leaves on her tree really are green, in the balloon game sense, in the basic sense of the word. They appear wholly and literally greenish in normal lighting conditions to normal viewers. And in virtue of that, they are green in a basic or primary sense. However, when we move on to the second scenario, where the biologist asks for some leaves that are green, I think Pia again says something that is true when she says the leaves on my tree are green. However, that's misleading, obviously, in this context, because the biologist was after leaves that are green in their natural condition. And that doesn't apply to the leaves that Pia has painted, obviously. So it is misleading of her to say, in this new context, the leaves on my tree are green, because although it's literally true, the biologist was after more than that. Not merely leaves that are green in the primary and basic sense, but leaves that are green in that sense and still in their natural condition. Right. OK, that was an unspoken assumption in the telephone conversation. It didn't get mentioned because it was taken as obvious. If she had been completely candid, what she would have said would be something like, well, I've got some green leaves, but they're not naturally green. If you're after naturally green leaves, then you'll need to look elsewhere. So I think it's too simple for Travis to say there at the end of that quote, but now Pia speaks falsehood. She goes on speaking a literal truth, but she implies a falsehood, and that is relevant because she implies, namely, the falsehood that the leaves she's got are still in their natural state. That's implied. That's a kind of background implication in the conversation, and it's highly relevant in this situation, but she doesn't mention the fact that her leaves are no longer in there. Natural state. So that's misleading of her. She's giving false signals there. But what she actually says is strictly and literally true. So that's the way I would respond to the Travis case in order to keep the principle of compositionality going in the picture as a principle on which language use depends. Now, the final topic I'd like to discuss connects up with the topic of the first lecture, the context principle, because you might think, and some people have argued, that the principle of compositionality is not actually compatible with the context principle. They seem to be, superficially at any rate, they seem to be pulling in different directions. So if you remember, the context principle said, only in the context of a sentence does a word have meaning. And the principle of compositionality says that the meaning of a sentence is a function of the meanings of the words and the way they're put together. So it looks as though the context principle prioritizes the sentence, and it says that the primary unit of meaning is the sentence, and words and their meanings are an abstraction from sentences, something that are derived from sentences as an extra move, Whereas it seems the principle of compositionality is doing it the other way round. It's prioritizing the word and saying that you start off with a bunch of words and their meanings, and you can then construct sentences out of them. And the meanings of those sentences will be a function of the meanings of the words and the way they're put together. So if one's, you know, one might then ask, well, which comes first, sentence or word? And, well, to some extent, we discussed this last time, because there are various ways in which you might mean that question. You might mean it as a historical question. And I think what I suggested was that, although, of course, we don't know, it's overwhelmingly plausible that individual noises, whether one calls them words or not, I don't know, but individual sounds came first and were put together to form larger units of discourse, so that sentences, that's to say complex collections of words, came second historically. I think I said last time, well, that's the position that we generally assume. But of course, I was also defending the context principle, and in particular making use of Bentham's point that the words as we have them now are made for sentences. They have syntactic properties, so that it would be absurd, as Bentham said, to imagine that there were a lot of words as we know them now, you know, nouns and verbs and adverbs, like cat and road and quickly and go and kick. It would be absurd to imagine that fully formed words were dotted around the landscape, as I put it, and then some clever person thought how to put them together. That can't be the way it is, because the words, as I said, have essentially syntactic properties, and that means that they're already fitted up to go into sentences. And they already have combinatorial properties, ways of combining with other words. That's essential to them. So, as I say, there are various ways in which you might mean the question, which comes first, sentence or word. And, as I say, at first sight, the two principles that we're operating with, context and compositionality, might seem to deliver different answers to that question. Well, of course, last time we had a version of the same problem, if you like, because I was agreeing that, historically speaking, the individual noise came first and was later, it later coalesced with other noises to form what eventually became sentences, so that sentences were a late historical development. But I was also defending the context principle that the whole function of a word is to form a part of a sentence along with other words. Another way of putting that point, you see, would be to say, well, a word is not just like the early original noises, it's got syntactic properties, whereas the original noises that our ancestors came out with, if you go back far enough, that presumably they didn't have syntactic properties. They were simply individual sounds. So they didn't imply combinations with other sounds. Those really did come later. And you might say, just as a piece of terminology, well, we don't really have words, strictly speaking, until we have sounds that combine into sentences and have syntactic properties. But anyway, however one does the terminology, the fact was I was last time trying to combine priorities in both directions, in a sense. I was wanting to say, well, on the one hand, the individual component of the sentence came first historically, but from a theoretical point of view, the account of what a word is for and what it is goes via the sentence. Words are, as I have said, made for sentences. They're fitted up to function in sentences, and that is part of their essence. So that in that sense, it is right that sentences come first in a theoretical sense. Words are dependent on sentences for their function and point. So I think we can apply a similar strategy here in the case of the present apparent clash. By a similar strategy, what I mean is a relativizing strategy. You often find in philosophy that when you have two things which appear to be in tension, and you can't make up your mind which one to drop because really you want both, you often find that you can keep both if you can find some way of relativizing these two principles or arguments or points to different points of view. So that from a certain perspective, A is prior to B, and from another perspective, B is prior to A. And that's what we can do here. So from a theoretical perspective, you might say, or maybe a metaphysical perspective would be another way of putting it. If you're giving an account of what words and sentences are, what their functions are, what their point is, then the sentence does enjoy priority. In the sense that words are, as I've said, essentially syntactic objects, essentially such as to be formed into sentences. So that the account of what a word is goes through the sentence. But if you're giving an account of how we learn language, how we understand new sentences and so on, how language can be creative, as we said at the beginning, then you want to appeal to the principle of compositionality and say, well, words are like building blocks. They can be juggled around and formed into different sentences, into new sentences. And these new sentences can be understood because you already know the grammar, you know the framework into which these words are put. And although they're put into that framework in a novel way, you know that all the meanings of the individual words and you understand the framework itself, you know the grammar of the language. So that you can work out, you can compute the meaning of the new sentence. So that in that practical sense, you might say, from the language speaker's point of view, the practitioner's point of view, words are prior to sentences. Sentences are made up of words, new sentences are made up of old words, and that's how they can be understood. So the relativizing maneuver enables you to reconcile the principle of compositionality with the context principle. From one point of view, it's right to say that sentences are prior to words. From another point of view, it's right to say that words are prior to sentences. And those points of view don't exclude one another. They're not in competition with one another. Rather, they complement each other. So if you look on page 16 of my book, you'll see that I've given that kind of account following the lead of Michael Dummett, who says something very similar to that. The rest of the chapter, which I'm not now going to talk about, but which I would like you to have a look at and think about, concerns a complication that I haven't gone into. I've been talking all along about the principle of compositionality as though there were only one. And you'll see, when you look at some of the articles on the subject, that a lot of the discussion is conducted in those terms. However, some philosophers have distinguished between two different principles of compositionality, what's called a principle of forwards compositionality and a principle of reverse compositionality. And there is a question as to whether we want both of those, or just one, or indeed neither. If you haven't been convinced by my arguments and prefer to stick with the arguments of the objectors to the principle of compositionality. So this distinction complicates the picture somewhat. So have a look at pages 16 and onwards in the book, and I will stop there.